I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Roll back the clock and you can see a dramatic increase in spending on presidential elections. Here's what Mother Jones found in a recent edition of the magazine. The Reagan v. Carter race cost a little under $300 million. The Clinton v. Dole campaign spent a little more than $300 million. Bush and Kerry spent close to $900 million in 2004. And the Obama and McCain campaigns broke the record, spending almost $1.5 billion on their battle for the White House in 2008. And if the trend continues, and it looks like it will, this year will break that record. Today we want to look at how money is driving the 2012 presidential election and how it's affecting the political process. And we asked Dave Leventhal to join us. He's the politics and money reporter for Politico. Before joining Politico, he worked for 2 years as editor of OpenSecrets.org. That's OpenSecrets.org at the Center for Responsive Politics. And Dave Leventhal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure to be with you.
Looking at how much has been raised so far, is there any way to know, since so much of this money comes through secret doorways, do we know how much money has been raised so far for the presidential campaigns?
We know that it's probably going to be well into the billions of dollars when all is said and done. At this juncture, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and really kind of getting into that territory of millions to billions right now. Now, of course, it's important to note that the number literally is changing every moment. What is the number today will not be the number tomorrow, because there may be millions, if not tens of millions of dollars more spent just within a 24-hour period. So overall, what we're talking about is certainly the most expensive political election in the history of the United States, and that's true with the presidential race, but it's also true overall with federal races when you lump in all of the House races and all of the Senate races that are taking place. It really is a multi-billion dollar proposition that we are looking at, for better or for worse.
And how much can this be laid at the feet of Citizens United?
Well, certainly what we're seeing this election cycle, this presidential election cycle, that is markedly different from even 2008 when Barack Obama and John McCain were fighting it out, is that there has been a widening of the channel in terms of outside influence that's pouring into the presidential and other federal races. So you've probably heard the term like super PAC, in other terms, perhaps like a political nonprofit. Well, all of these types of groups that either didn't exist in 2008 or are taking on new prominence here in 2012 are spending at record levels, really spending more money than even a lot of people thought they would, even in the advent of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission Supreme Court decision back in 2010. That was one among many federal cases, in fact, that helped trigger and help widen this channel of outside money into political elections.
Well, let's take apart super PACs and some of these political nonprofits. A super PAC can accept unlimited contributions but must disclose donors. Am I correct on that?
That is correct, and a super PAC didn't exist prior to the Citizens United decision. The Citizens United decision, coupled with another federal court case, one called SpeechNow.org versus FEC, really helped usher in the era of the super PAC. And indeed, they can raise and spend unlimited sums of money, and they can do so whenever they want. They can say whatever they want. And at the end of the day, they have the ability to pretty much do whatever they want, so long as they do not directly coordinate with the candidate that they are supporting. Now, the caveat to that is many of these super PACs, particularly the ones that are raising the most money, are run by former officials of the candidates that they're supporting. Two good examples would be Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. A super PAC called Restore Our Future, which is supporting Mitt Romney, is run in part by former surrogates of his. Barack Obama, a super PAC supporting his called Priorities USA Action, is run by two former White House staffers that were very close to him, including Bill Burton and Sean Sweeney, who were very key right-hand men for Barack Obama for several years while he was president. So they know the playbook. They know what what's on the minds of these candidates. So you don't have to necessarily sit down at a boardroom table with the candidates or their campaigns to know what they want done, what their issues are, and what their messaging is going to be, because these are the message makers for the candidates, just kind of taking on a new role and taking on a new job and being able to have the tools at their disposal to go and spend millions upon millions of dollars to message on behalf of the candidate that they are very close to.
Now, they're supposed to not coordinate. Does that mean that they can't talk to each other, or they can't have any kind of contact whatsoever?
This has been a very tortured question this
election cycle.
And really what the law says is that you're not supposed to actually have a face-to-face or some sort of direct coordination with the campaign where you're reading from the same playbook, you're sketching up plays and plans, and that's what it's really meant by. But there have been some examples that a lot of campaign finance reform advocates, for example, have thought have been egregious violations of this. One that was largely lampooned over the past couple of days was when Sheldon Adelson, who is a billionaire casino mogul, he's donated $20 million to various Republican causes, and that number is going up by the day. He sat right in the front row of an event that Mitt Romney was having, and yet Sheldon Adelson has donated just an incredible amount of money to the Super PAC that is supporting Mitt Romney. So it's something that really no federal agency is really willing to take on with a very strict tack, but it's something that definitely is happening. If they're not coordinating, they're walking pretty darn close up to the line right now.
Well, I'm looking at something from the Center for Responsive Politics, where you used to work. Something like 26 billionaires have donated more than $61 million to super PACs.
And that really is the overriding story of super PACs, that they're primarily funded by people who have incredible amounts of wealth. And on one hand, you have the argument saying, well, that's terrible for democracy, and that's really an egregious thing that that really should be changed, because why should somebody who just simply has a whole lot of money be able to have such a great role, such a prominent role in the trajectory of a political campaign? But there is another school of thought, too, that says, well, this is actually pretty good, because ultimately you have outside groups and you have outside voices that have the ability, even if it is being funded by people who are very wealthy, at least the ideas that are being espoused are able to be disseminated all throughout the country in a way that perhaps they wouldn't be able to if it was just the candidates themselves and their campaigns kind of driving the train on these issues. So that's been a major point of contention and a major debate that rages to this day, and really hasn't settled down a whole lot ever since the Citizens United decision. And if anything, and this discussion is probably indicative of that, is probably more pointed today than it even was when this was all first happening.
Does this go back to Buckley-Villeo, where basically, you can't separate speech and money?
Indeed, and you can go back 100 years back to Teddy Roosevelt when he was taking his big stick and trust busting and trying to get corporations out of the money game. The bottom line with campaign finance is that you wait about 5 minutes and it changes. It's like, the weather in the most turbulent places in the United States. And you've had numerous examples even in just the past 10 years where the rules have shifted, and they've shifted sometimes underfoot, right in the middle of an election cycle. So what, is happening today is not what is happening tomorrow. And we've even seen that this election cycle with a couple of lawsuits that have gone forward. Chris Van Hollen, who's a congressional representative from Maryland, he has sued the Federal Election Commission. Other people have sued the Federal Election Commission to try to change the rules again in the middle of the game. And that just speaks to sort of the overall nature of campaign finance. People are just never satisfied with what they've got, and there are people on both sides of the coin, advocates on both sides who want more regulation or who want more deregulation, battling it out in the courts, in Congress, through elections themselves, and oftentimes there are numerous venues to try to assert your influence when it comes to determining what the ultimate rules are going to be.
So those are how super PACs work. Now, you mentioned these political nonprofits. These are what, tax-exempt, sort of social, and I'm using quotation marks here, tax-exempt organizations?
There are, and there's several different flavors, if you will, of outside organizations that can, to one degree or another degree, engage in the political process. And political nonprofits or nonprofit organizations, not to get too technical with you here, that are organized under the IRS's 501c4 code. And they're supposed to be organizations set up to benefit the social welfare in its most general of senses. But several of them have taken on very, very notable political roles, have raised an incredible amount of money, and spent an incredible amount of money on advertisements and other communications that are ostensibly of a political nature. Now, many of these advertisements are what are called issue advertisements. So they're not directly advocating for or against a candidate. They're not telling you to go vote for Barack Obama or go vote for Mitt Romney, but they're oftentimes talking about the candidates in a very, very negative, or for that matter, positive context, depending on the group, depending on the advertisement. And, you know, if you're watching it and you know two things about politics, you can tell that this is a political advertisement of some sort.
With these political nonprofits, do they have to disclose the names of their donors?
They do not, and this is really kind of the big sticking point that we've had this election cycle, because many of them, even though they are not, by law, supposed to have a primary purpose of engaging in the political process, seem to be playing politics more than they're doing anything else. They're not going and necessarily doing much more than buying a whole lot of television ads or buying a whole lot of radio ads and talking about very politicized issues or talking about candidates. So kind of walking right up to that line of advocating for or against candidates, but not doing so. And because of the nature of what they are, they do not indeed have to disclose where they're getting their money from. And this is something that legislation has been drawn up and has not passed, and lawsuits have been filed and had some degree of success that have tried to address what some folks feel is a major problem and sort of cognitive dissonance, that you'd have some groups that have to reveal who their donors are. You have other groups who don't have to reveal who their donors are, and they're all kind of generally doing the same thing as it applies to political communications.
And we're almost up in a break here, but that's the Disclose Act. Is that what you're referring to right there?
It is, and there was the Disclose Act 1, the Disclose Act 2, a legislation that was filed back last congressional cycle, and this congressional cycle. Both went a whole lot of nowhere, and advocates for it, though, say that they're going to yet try again, but a legislative remedy, if remedy for the people who think that this is a problem, really has not been able to pass through what is an incredibly divided Congress, as you well know, and a Congress that's going to certainly be divided all the way up until Election Day, if not beyond that.
And was that divided along party lines?
It very much was. The Republicans, generally speaking, are very much dead set against it, and the Democrats are very much for it, although there have been people on both sides who have supported the opposite of what the majority of their party is doing.
That's Dave Leventhal, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about politics and money, campaign finance. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. And Dave is the politics and money reporter for Politico. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Craft Spoken Here, a celebration of the museum's collection of American, European, and Asian craft. Craft Spoken Here highlights Philadelphia's craft tradition and is designed to connect you with the crafting community through the Craft Lab, a space within the exhibition dedicated to demonstrating and exploring craft techniques. On view through August 12th. Details at philamuseum.org.
Next time in Studio 360, the violinist Hilary Hahn on her new record of completely improvised music.
I tend to follow my instincts and I follow my interests in the projects that I do. And I think people understand that this is something that I really wanted to try.
Hillary Hahn and Hauschka, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The glamour and excitement of the Olympics is hard to miss, and it could inspire parents to push their kids to get involved and stay involved in sports. But that raises the age-old question of how much pressure is too much, when to push and when to fall back, how to be a sports parent without becoming a jerk about it. We'll talk about that next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dave Leventhal from Politico about our system of campaign finance and also talking about why reform has been so elusive over the years and the impact of various court decisions on campaign finance. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Dave, something you wrote, the FEC ruled on Friday that nonprofits, we were just talking about them, that air ads that refer to federal candidates have to report the names and addresses of donors. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. And this is one of the court decisions that we talked about just a moment ago, which is happening right in the middle of an election cycle and very well could change the rules in midstream, if you will. And the bottom line is that there are a lot of organizations, these nonprofit organizations being among them, that do not disclose their donors. And as a result, there was a lawsuit that came about that tried to force them to disclose their donors in certain situations. And the Federal Election Commission basically said, okay, we're going to go ahead and begin to enforce the court decision that said that these types of groups who are engaging in certain types of political advertisements are going to have to reveal who's funding them. But there's sort of a loophole in all of this. And again, without getting too technical, there is an ability for some of these groups, and in fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a very, very active organization, both business-wise and politically, is saying, well, you know, we're still going to be able to not disclose our donors because we're just going to change the kind of the nature of the advertisement. We're going to be more explicit in who we're actually supporting or not supporting. And by law, they're able to occlude their donors as a result of, bottom line, just changing the way that they're actually messaging when they put up a television advertisement. So still a lot of frustration among the campaign finance advocates out there saying that, well, you know, we think we've taken a step forward, and in fact we're taking two steps back afterward.
Do these groups fear the FEC?
No. I don't think most do, and we've written a lot about the Federal Election Commission, which five out of the six members right now are serving actually in holdover status. That means that their terms have expired. President Obama has been seemingly disinterested in appointing anyone to the FEC. He's tried once. That got stalled in the Senate, and he hasn't tried again. He could, in fact, be the first president in the United States to not successfully appoint somebody to the FEC during a four-year term, which, again, is much to the delight of people who feel that there should be less regulation in the campaign finance arena, but much to the chagrin of people who feel that there should be more regulation.
Do you understand why he hasn't appointed somebody or named somebody?
We've reached out to the White House on many occasions in regards to this very question, and basically what they've said is that it's not for a lack of trying, and they cite the one time where they did offer up somebody to replace one of the expired terms or people who are serving an expired term, but then they also point to congressional gridlock, that they don't want to spend time and effort on something that may be fruitless. Then, of course, you have plenty of folks who would like to see him just try for the sake of trying, or try in order to shine light on the issue, make it a little bit more symbolic, but at the end of the day, he's had very little success, and he's not gone that route of trying just for the sake of trying.
So are we seeing money that might have gone to political parties now migrating over to these political nonprofits or to these super PACs?
We have, and perhaps even the larger issue is that it's not so much money migrating, where a dollar that would go to Group A is now going to a dollar to Group B, but it's a dollar is going to Group A and another dollar is going to Group B. That is to say, a party committee might receive a donation from somebody who's very wealthy. A candidate might receive a donation from somebody who's very wealthy. And then that same person will go and turn around and make a large dollar donation to a super PAC that's supportive of the party or the candidate that he or she is supporting, and then go around and make another donation to a nonprofit organization that's also being supportive of a certain ideology or a certain candidate. So really, if you are wealthy and you are politically active, you have a menu of options for you to try to spread around your political wealth and try to spread around your political influence.
If someone wants to give directly to a candidate, let's say a presidential candidate, there are, though, limitations on how much you can give, correct?
There are. So if anyone wants to donate to Mitt Romney or donate to Barack Obama, they can give $2,500 for a single election cycle. So that's $2,500 in the primary, $2,500 in the general. And here we are talking about millions of dollars, and that's really what the situation is. You are very limited in your ability as an individual, or you're limited completely as a corporation when it comes to donating directly to a candidate. So, for example, if ExxonMobil or AT&T, just to pick on two corporations, decided that they wanted to give a donation directly to Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, they would be prohibited by law for doing that. But if they wanted to turn around, and they have not done this, although other corporations have, if they want to go and give $1 million or $10 million to a super PAC that's supporting Mitt Romney or Barack Obama, they can do so now. And that's really kind of the big difference that we have right now, and also sort of the chasm that exists between what you can do as it regards your political money for a political campaign versus a super PAC that is supporting a political campaign.
Here's a really dumb question, but you hear about these candidates having, you know, a $50,000 a plate dinner as a fundraiser. How does that work? Is that through a super PAC? Does that go directly to the candidate? I've never quite understood how that is supposed to work, at least legally speaking.
It is confusing, and it's something called a joint fundraising committee. Now, both Democrats and Republicans use these per course, and what a joint fundraising committee basically allows a candidate to do is team up with a party committee. So, for example, Barack Obama might team up with the Democratic National Committee. Mitt Romney will team up with the RNC, the Republican analogy, and in perhaps other political committees, political party committees that are like-minded with the candidate. So what that joint fundraising committee can do is raise a big old sum of money from people attending one of these very large, very high-profile events, and they can raise a greater dollar sum from wealthy individuals. And then what the joint committees will do is they will spread that wealth all along the line to their member organizations, which will include a candidate, will include a party committee, maybe include some state party committee, and ultimately it is supposed to all adhere to federal regulations for each level, each contribution level, to every one of the member organization. But it's just a way to make the process more efficient so that somebody doesn't have to cut 9 different checks.
But the candidate gets something out of it as well, yes?
Gets something out of it. But Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, they're not pocketing the $50,000. They're getting their cut of it that they legally can get, and then they're spreading the rest of the wealth to the party committees, which by law can raise actually a greater amount of money than presidential candidates or congressional candidates.
Is that because of McCain-Feingold?
That's actually because of long-standing rules that have changed. And McCain-Feingold, back in 2002, that legislation did have an effect on this process as well. But still, as a political party committee, you can take in a significant amount of money, but you cannot, as a political party committee, take in an unlimited sum of money, which actually, back in the day, if you go back long enough, about 13, 14, 15 years ago, you might remember the term soft money. And that was just another stage in the evolution of campaign finance money, where political parties were sort of the super PACs of their day back in the 90s, and now perhaps have been a little bit overtaken in prominence by super PACs, at least as it pertains to the messaging, the communications, the big dollar advertisements that so many people are seeing, particularly in swing states and particularly in states that have a lot at stake, and Pennsylvania is probably one of them.
Indeed, and that's Dave Leventhal. He's politics and money reporter for Politico. He was the editor of OpenSecrets.org at the Center for Responsive Politics, and we invited him to join us on Radio Times to help us understand how we, as a country, by law, are allowed to finance political campaigns. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So if you look at the Republican primary campaign in the fall, and now we're in the thick of the general election, although the conventions haven't taken place yet. Nonetheless, lots of money is being spent. I'm assuming TV stations, radio stations, are just up to their eyeballs in cash.
No, they're loving it. This has been such a boon for them. And if you talk to TV stations in places like Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina, some of the early primary states, they were just simply running out of time for all intents and purposes when it came to the space that they had to run the advertisements that were being placed on their airwaves. And we're kind of seeing this again now, especially in swing states. Here in D.C., we're seeing it all the time because Virginia is about the swingiest of swing states that you possibly can find. And, of course, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, all the super PACs, many nonprofit organizations, they're on the air all the time with various messages of various stripes, but here it is in July, and all you're seeing is these advertisements. So imagine what it's going to be like in August, September, October, when effectively every dollar that can be spent on mass broadcasts, on mass messaging, is going to be spent by these campaigns because, hey, they're going to unload their clip the most that they possibly can with their political cash leading right up to Election Day.
Does anyone know if these ads work?
Well, they certainly do, and I think you could point to two very prime examples during the Republican presidential primary. A guy by the name of Newt Gingrich was doing awfully well in places like Iowa and in national polls, for that matter, and Mitt Romney was not doing so well. So a super PAC called Restore Our Future that is, to this day, very supportive of Mitt Romney and has been one of the most successful fundraising super PACs of all during this election cycle. They decided that they were just going to invest millions upon millions of dollars into not promoting Mitt Romney, not lovingly boosting him in advertisements and showing what a great guy he was, but going to the wall to tear down Newt Gingrich. And, well, what happened? Newt Gingrich started to drop in the polls very precipitously. Mitt Romney ended up doing quite well in the polls as time went on, and in the rest is history. So there definitely is a strong correlation, even if there isn't a demonstrable causation, with these types of ads coming from these outside groups. And a little corollary to that is that in South Carolina, Newt Gingrich sort of had his moment in the sun when he won that state's presidential primary by having a super PAC that was very supportive of him kind of read from the same playbook and go very, very negative on Mitt Romney and gave Newt Gingrich a boost, temporary as it was.
And wasn't that Sheldon Adelson who's now supporting Romney?
Absolutely. And Sheldon Adelson, if you don't know that name, get to know it, because
yes,
he, in fact, has been probably one of the most important players in U.S. politics this election cycle. He's a billionaire casino mogul. He has millions upon millions, and in fact, tens of millions of dollars to spend. One of the wealthiest men in the United States of America, and in fact, the world. And he really likes to play politics and gave tens of millions of dollars to a super PAC supporting Newt Gingrich. When Newt dropped out of the race, then he started giving tens of millions of dollars to Restore Our Future, the pro-Mitt Romney super PAC.
Let me ask you one more thing about Citizens United. It gave corporations essentially First Amendment rights that individuals have. It also gave unions that same right. Are unions spending on that same level as corporations?
Unions have, to a much lesser degree, formed super PACs, but unions have always been very politically active just out of the organizations that they've had. A lot of people don't realize that unions are actually nonprofit corporations organized under a different code, under IRS law, but in regulations. But they've been, I guess you could say, slow to embrace the era of the super PAC, but have still been spending to their own right right, tens of millions of dollars on politics. They are very powerful in their own right, but they are quite demonstrably different from a corporation, some blue chip, a Procter & Gamble or a Verizon or whatnot, because they don't exist to make money to sell a product. They exist to represent and are kind of political in nature by representing people who are affiliated and associated with that union. But make no mistake, they are very powerful political forces all the same.
Let me get Charles from Warminster to join our conversation. Charles, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty and Dave. My question is, can contributors write off their contributions on their federal income tax forms?
Are they deductible, you're asking, right?
Yes, is all that deductible?
Is that deductible, Dave?
They are not. So if you make a donation to a nonprofit organization that that plays politics, one of these, again, 501c4 groups, one of these social welfare organizations, you can't, in fact, cannot take a deduction off your taxes. Now, that's different from if you donate to a charity, sort of as if most people would think of a charity, something that's, existing to fight cancer or do great works for a certain type of charitable cause, feed the hungry, be it what it may. That definitely would be tax deductible, but those types of groups are very limited in the types of political activity that they can engage in. There are much more strict regulations that apply to them and that they must adhere to in order to keep their tax-exempt status.
Charles, thanks for the call. Dave, whatever happened to public financing of presidential campaigns?
It has died a very, very, very quick death. If you just go back two election cycles, everyone was pretty much engaging in the public financing system, and there had been a couple of exceptions to that rules, but really the wheels began to fall off in 2008, and public financing advocates kind of scratched their head about this, but you can really kind of lay it at Barack Obama's feet for kind of getting the ball rolling when it comes to the public financing system as it is today and as it still is today, kind of falling apart. And he decided against taking public financing so that he could raise an unlimited amount of money for his campaign. At the end of the day, he was the most successful presidential candidate in raising money during a single election, raising about $750 million during the 2008 campaign. Wildly successful, of course. And John McCain was probably kicking himself for actually engaging in the public financing system. Well, come 2012, nobody engaged in it except for the most minor of candidates, and really the system that had been set up to provide public financing for presidential candidates is obsolete, and there has been some talk of trying to retool it or pass laws that would make it much more attractive to presidential candidates or even force it upon presidential candidates, but that's a discussion for another day, because this election cycle, there's no way there's no chance that this is going to have any relevance to what happens in November.
And about 30 seconds before our second break here, but looking at what Obama did in 2008, raising $750 million. Was that from big donations, little donations, a combination of the two?
It was a combination of the two, but he was very, very successful in being able to marshal small dollar donors to go and make the $5, $10, $50, $100 donations that, when cobbled together, made a big difference in his campaign and also gave him the opportunity to get so many people, tens and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, to buy into his campaign. So not all the time is it just about making a donation and getting that $5 or $10. It's about somebody buying into your campaign so that they'll volunteer for you, they'll make phone calls for you, they feel like they're a part of it.
And that's Dave Leventhal. He is the politics and money reporter for Politico. He worked for a couple of years as editor of OpenSecrets.org. That's at the Center for Responsive Politics. And we are talking about politics and money and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Westchester University supports WHYY. Westchester University's Master's of Special Education degree will be offered in Philadelphia starting this fall. Teachers interested in a graduate degree in special education can attend classes at Westchester University's 7th and Market Street location, just one block from Independence Mall in downtown Philadelphia. Applications are now being accepted. Details at wcupa.edu/philly. That's wcupa.edu/philly. Westchester University. Learn more.
Congress is poised for another showdown on the deficit and taxes, and we're facing the so-called fiscal cliff. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Wessel about how the federal budget got to this point and the tough choices to be made. He's the author of Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget, and he's economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A huge government database is being built in Utah. It'll data mine the contents of everyone's private emails, cell phones, and Google searches. Would it have found the Colorado shooter? Also, Rufus Wainwright on being a father, backing off his love affair with Judy Garland. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. As our guest David Leventhal said, the 2012 presidential election is on track to be the most expensive in U.S. history. Between donations to individual candidates, to the parties, through super PACs and political nonprofits, there are a number of ways to underwrite the race for the White House. We're talking about how our campaign finance system works, what contributors get for their donations, and why reform has been so elusive. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Dave, what does a donor get for their money? Is there any way to evaluate that?
You can anecdotally, and it's sort of the high end of it. You can earn yourself or pay your way to an ambassadorship. You can pay your way to a role of great prominence within a campaign. You can get yourself different perks that somebody would very much like if they're investing a huge amount of money or bundling a huge amount of money for a political campaign. Bundling is where you act as a major surrogate and get other people to donate, and then you deliver that money to a candidate. But going back to the ambassador example, and this is not unique to Republicans or Democrats, they oftentimes will have political patrons at a one-fourth, one-third rate in terms of people who are getting plum jobs as ambassadors of various countries. So you make your big dollar donations, mm-hmm. and you kind of at the end of the day say, hey, you know, I helped you out, now what's in it for me?
I can't tell you how many elected officials or people running for office, mostly elected officials, when you ask them this question, they say, no, you know, I treat everybody the same.
And a lot of them will certainly say that, and to a degree they are right that that not everyone who's making a big dollar contribution to their campaign is going to get wildly special treatment, but the people who are kind to you the most oftentimes get recognized by candidates who are successful because they, number one, have the ability to recognize them in a very prominent way, and number two, want to make sure that when they run for re-election again and as they go through their political career that they keep those people on their sides, because certainly with elections happening every 2 years or every 4 years or every 6 years, they're going to need to tap those people's wallets again.
And how much time do elected officials spend looking for money, asking for money?
A great deal more than they used to.
Really?
And there have been various studies that have floated around that have just sort of quantified the ever-expanding amount of time that candidates, particularly presidential candidates, are spending fundraising. And as elections get more and more expensive, and there's sort of a mutually assured destruction element to all of this, you've got to have an arms race of cash, if you will, they feel the need to just fundraise ever more than they have before. But, you know, also, too, it is important to note, just anecdotally, that when I talk with congressional candidates or members of Congress and ask them the question, well, you know, are you spending more time than ever fundraising? I get very few answers that are no, I'm spending less time fundraising. Mm. And that kind of speaks to the question of, okay, well, there's the law of scarcity. You know, you can only spend an hour doing A or B, and if you are spending much of that time doing fundraising activity and dialing for dollars and trying to get people to donate to your campaign, you're going to have less time to be able to spend doing the work that you were sent to Washington, D.C. to do, and many of them will acknowledge that straight up and find it to be a flaw in the system, but something that is very, mm-hmm. very difficult to fix because of partisan considerations.
But it seems that super PACs can do the job of a candidate. I mean, they're not supposed to, quote-unquote, coordinate, but if they're essentially on the same political page, but they can do the fundraising and also the advertising that the candidate cannot.
And they can, and definitely that's the case at the presidential level. At the congressional level, although there are some very notable examples of super PACs involving themselves in House races or Senate races, and states like Indiana, Nebraska, Texas, and California have certainly seen that type of congressional activity, the vast majority of congressional campaigns and congressional candidates don't have that type of support, at least to the degree of a nationwide presidential campaign. So they're still stuck, you know, running their own campaign, and as a result, having to fundraise themselves and having to rely on their own fundraising and their own financial ingenuity in order to run the campaign that they want to run.
Let me get Robert from Avondale to join us. Robert, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi,
hi,
Marty. This is a great, great show.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your guests and the callers that have called in.
Excellent.
They have some wonderful comments and questions.
Great.
My comment, and I'm just gonna make this comment, and then I'll get off the air.
Okie doke.
It just seems to me that with Citizens United, with that decision, we all know that rich people are going to have more voice anyway, and that's just a fact of life. But to codify it into law by the highest court in the land, you look to the highest court in the land to defend the defenseless, but to like give them this extra weapon, I just think it's dangerous. This is kind of like, as my father used to say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I'm not even sure the intentions in this case were that good. Anyway, that's my comment, and I just want to thank you again for this great show.
Well, thank you, Robert. Thanks for the comment. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Dave, he's not alone in this.
Not at all, and this has been the main argument from folks who want to, again, change the campaign finance system, either through the courts, even through a constitutional amendment, which is something that's been floated throughout Congress and by advocates who feel that the system is broken the way that it is. Now, of course, a constitutional amendment is about one of the most difficult things to do in American politics. I believe the last time the Constitution was amended was 2 decades ago, but it all speaks to the sentiment that a lot of people feel that the system is indeed just poised and primed for yet another change that's going to roll back Citizens United and do away with this. But there are plenty of voices out there, and we talk to them frequently, who say Citizens United has actually been a good thing for the political process, that it's expanded the marketplace of ideas. It's given people an ability to exercise their First Amendment rights to an even greater degree than they have before. And it's just, again, this very, very strong, pointed, picked standoff that you have between these two very strong forces and two very moneyed forces as well.
Robert, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. We are talking about money and politics today on Radio Times with our guest, Dave Leventhal. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Dave, you did an article about President Obama, and as we all know, at his State of the Union address, essentially called out the U.S. Supreme Court on this Citizens United decision. But you also seem to criticize President Obama for not doing much to actually change or at least challenge the Supreme Court decision. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, the criticism that we wrote about in the story is really coming, ironically, from campaign finance advocates themselves, some of whom are very prominent names in the campaign finance reform movement, who basically said that President Obama has not done enough during his time in office to try to roll back some of the decisions like Citizens United, not spent enough political capital. And that's been a big disappointment to them, and they had very strong words for the president in articulating this, because the president has been, at least in word and to a degree in deed, a very strong advocate of trying to get influence out of the political system as much as possible. He's done some things that have been to the delight of campaign finance reform advocates and people who think that there's too much outside influence in politics, such as limiting the ability for lobbyists to lobby the White House. He's talked a very good game going forward and says that a lot's going to change in his second term if he was to get one. But still, at this point, there are a lot of unhappy people who expected more from the president.
You had a piece recently about how big companies are actually spending less on lobbying. That's the headline. Why do you think that is?
A lot of it has to do with Congress, and this will ebb and flow. This will be a bit cyclical, and when it comes to actual direct traditional lobbying up here in D.C. and on Capitol Hill. But we did, in fact, see that a lot of the largest companies and unions and special interest groups had to drop their lobbying spending in the second quarter. And when we talked to many of them, they said, well, there just isn't a whole lot going on in Congress that we want to spend our money lobbying on. We can either save our money for a later date, and believe me, there's going to be a lot of action once we get to budget cut talks and whatnot later this year, or use that money in a different realm on sort of non-traditional lobbying, grassroots work, various other things that are within the political realm, but not just under the definition of hiring a lobbyist, going up to Capitol Hill, and trying to twist somebody's arm on a bill or a piece of legislation.
We've been talking a lot about super PACs, but you have an article about something called the Super PAC. What is that?
Well, again, it just goes back to the very turbulent and tumultuous election cycle that we've had, where there was the legalization of yet another type of political organization. We like to call them hybrid PACs or super PACs. And what these basically are super PACs that can do all the things that super PACs can do and raise and spend unlimited sums of money, but they can also have an operation within their overall structure that operates like a traditional political action committee. And the big difference with a super PAC and a traditional PAC, if you will, is that traditional PACs can donate directly to candidates, whereas super PACs can only spend money to independently support candidates. So it's kind of the best of both worlds, and we've seen several dozen examples, including some notable names that have gone this route of creating both a super PAC and a traditional PAC, merging them together and creating one of these super PACs.
Is that legal?
It's very legal, and there was a decision that came down in 2011 that said that, in fact, creating a super PAC or a hybrid PAC was okay. And ever since that happened, there's been a movement among some traditional PACs and super PACs both to go the hybrid route.
What's so interesting is when you look at the history of campaign finance going back to, let's say, the Nixon administration, when people literally were bringing in paper bags of money into the White House, then you had reforms that came after Watergate, the establishment of the FEC, then you have money, soft money that was going to political parties, and you get McCain-Feingold, then you get Citizens United, you get Speech Now, and here we are, you know, discussing all the various ways that people can funnel money to either candidates or campaigns.
And it's not my job to predict the future, but I'll do it anyway.
Go ahead.
Expect more and more changes of the sort going forward, and ones that couldn't even predict maybe a half year ago or a year ago. For example, it was illegal to make a donation to a candidate via text message, and now there's a legal system in place that the Federal Election Commission gave their okay to actually make a direct contribution via text message on your phone, and it's something that's still being set up, but very much in motion. And Twitter, there's a company out there that allows you to make donations to a candidate or to a political committee via Twitter very easily. So technology is factoring into this just in the past couple of months that could, in future days, change the way that not only corporations and unions and special interests are engaging with political committees and political money, but also the way individuals just using their smartphone are able to do it as well.
And what about candidates spending their own money? Are there any limitations on that?
There's not, and it's a funny thing, self-funded campaigns, because on one hand you would think, oh, well, if somebody's got $50 million to spend on their own campaign, they're almost certainly going to win. But in fact, the opposite proves true. Last election cycle, roughly speaking, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but about one in five candidates who were defined as self-funders, people who were throwing in $500,000 or more of their own money into their campaign, they really only won about one in five times when you consider their race from the get-go all the way to the general election. So a lot of times people don't look very strongly on self-funders, or the self-funders think that they can kind of buy an election or maybe have a much greater prominence because of their wealth, but end up not being able to connect with voters to a very strong degree because they either don't have a political operation or they're just not very compelling candidates.
Do you think disclosure / sunlight would help, though, open up the system so at least we can see where money is going and whose name is attached to it?
There's definitely voices from all camps that feel that that transparency is a good thing, and that's actually one area where at least there is some degree of agreement among Democrats and Republicans. Now, you can argue the points of what should be more transparent or less, but even Mitt Romney was saying, hey, I don't like the idea of super PACs in principle. If it was up to me, what I would see would be total transparency with contributions, but that people could give much more money to candidates themselves. So instead of funneling the money to the super PACs or to outside political organizations, just give the money directly to the campaigns so that the campaigns can spend it however they want to, but that those donations would be available for all to see. Now, a lot of Republicans will say, as the rules stand right now, that transparency is a bad thing for nonprofit organizations that shouldn't have to reveal who their donors are, but it's really going to come down to perhaps who wins the White House and who wins Congress that will determine how the laws change yet again. About the only thing we do know is that the laws will indeed probably change once again.
And we're almost out of time here, but this is often described as an arms race. Do you see it that way?
It very much is an arms race, because if somebody has a whole lot of money and is running against an opponent who doesn't have a whole lot of money, you're just going to be able to do so much more politically than your opponent is going to do. So that opponent, and Barack Obama is a good example, too. He does not like the idea of super PACs. He does not like Citizens United as a decision. But back in February, when he was really getting his hat handed to him by a lot of outside groups, made the decision, strategic as it may be. Some people criticize him as being hypocritical, but he said, okay, you know, large dollar donors, it's okay for you to donate to this super PAC that is supporting me. So it's really just kind of coming up and facing the political realities of the day that he did, criticize him or not for it, but he felt he had to compete and had to engage in that arms race if he was going to have a really, really solid chance of running the campaign that he wanted to against Mitt Romney.
Well, Dave Leventhal, thank you so much for bringing some clarity to our convoluted system. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And he's the politics and money reporter for Politico. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out about this program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. And do stay.